welcome to the Missing Maura Murray podcast. I'm Tim, here tonight with Lance. Lance, how are you?
Pretty exhausted. I feel like we've come to the end of a, or we're coming to the end of a long hike.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. This has been a journey for the listeners, for us, for everyone involved in this case. Tonight, we're going to do a new introduction episode, sort of a rehash of episode one. We're going to talk about some of the key points in this mystery, this disappearance of 21-year-old Maura Murray. We are going to explain some of the theories and talk about some of the characters involved, characters being family members of Maura, friends of Maura's, and some of the people that we've had on this podcast who have theories.
I want to take it back a step and say, I'm not exhausted like we're coming out of the woods from a long hike. It's more like I'm exhausted because we've reached, or we see the summit, and you feel the sense of some accomplishment, and there's more to come. I don't want to make it seem so finalist. This is us approaching the summit of something that we never thought when we started this we would ever see. At one point we got a long way and hiked above the tree line, and then we realized that we were above the tree line and now we can see the summit. And it's a cool feeling, but it's surreal, and in a very real sense it's draining.
And I don't hike, so your hiking analogies are a little bit lost on me. But I think what you're trying to say is that there is a new investigative series, a six-part investigative series on this case that is premiering Saturday, September 23rd at 8:15 p.m. Eastern and Pacific time. And they've moved up this date 1 week.
Which is extremely exciting, right?
Oh, I can't wait.
There I go, coming up with this like really thought out scenario, this great metaphor. You know, you're hiking and I'm, you know, making it topical with the White Mountains, so people are picturing this. And basically what I was trying to say was that there's a show coming out.
And the show is produced by a production company called Texas Crew Productions, Emmy-winning production company. Great people to work with. And they've also got a brand new series that has just started airing on the History Channel called The Dark Files. Make sure to check that one out.
And the topic of The Dark Files is the astounding case, the Montauk Chronicles, which involve military conspiracies and a lot of kind of scary stuff. So excited to see that show.
So these guys are great. They reached out to us a while back. At that point, we had been working on a documentary of our own, an independent documentary. Lance and I are filmmakers. That is our background. And we were working on this documentary, have been working on it since December of 2013. And we started the podcast, this podcast, in July of 2015 to further the documentary. Our documentary was intended to be about the citizen detectives who are obsessed with this case. And we find that to be very interesting, this obsession that has grown out of this disappearance of Maura Murray. It's kind of a fascinating part of Maura Murray going missing. And it's important not to lose sight that this is a real person.
That's one of the things that happened to us during the whole journey of the podcast of missing Maura Murray. We wanted to do the documentary. We wanted these people who were such interesting, rich characters in this story. We wanted to talk to them. We thought that their story would make for a fascinating piece. And I think briefly we did lose fact that this is about a human being, because these personalities are so overwhelming and consuming. So early on in the podcast, as we looked into all of these characters who we just thought were characters, and we sort of mislabeled them and thought of them, I guess, as you know, characters in a book or characters in some sort of, you know, thing that we were watching. They have personalities and they're connected to the case and they're connected to Maura for the most part in some way. And that brought out a giant human element for me anyway.
And I think it's important to say that when we began this documentary, we began this podcast, it wasn't about trying to find more Murray. It was about documenting these citizen detectives, and we were seeing how far we can get with that. We never intended to talk to the Murray family. We never intended to attempt to make a difference in the case. But shortly after beginning the podcast, once the tips and the emails started coming in, we realized very quickly that we could make a difference. And right around that time was the time where we got contacted by David at Texas Crew Productions, and they said, would you like to investigate this with resources and a budget to do something and some time and a former U.S. Marshal? It was an honor to feel like we could actually help make a difference in this case. We are these filmmakers who became podcasters who are now investigators. And really all we were trying to do was document the effect that this missing person had on a community of people.
And at least for myself, I didn't feel like that transition of filmmaker to podcaster slash filmmaker to investigator, because when you know, filmmaking and podcasting is somewhat relatable. You're producing some sort of media that people are going to consume. And investigator, even when it's on a non-official level, is still a pretty significant jump for a field of interest. And it happened so gradually, and even that call that we initially received from David and Texas Crew, it never felt like everything's happening so fast. And maybe that's just my perception, my recollection of it, but I never once, like, even looking back now, it never strikes me as happening, oh, you know, this happened overnight. It happened so fast. It's been so pragmatic, which really speaks volumes to the production value and the level of investigation that the Texas Crew is putting forth, that they're not spontaneous. They're not impulsive. They're very pragmatic. And props to Oxygen Network for being the only network to take on something that was an open investigation, knowing that they would need a team of lawyers, that they would need to thoroughly vet all of the information, all of the footage, hundreds and hundreds of hours of footage. And that's just on like the post-production side leading into it. After it was greenlit by Oxygen, they're going into this investigation. They're going into the White Mountains of New Hampshire to talk to people who we knew at that time probably didn't want to be spoken to. So huge props to Oxygen to say this is worth it.
So it was a gradual transformation for us to go from filmmaker to podcaster to investigator, essentially. But at the end of the day, we're still amateurs at investigating. We've done 55 episodes now. We've been doing this for 2 years. We've learned on the job, but we don't have any formal training. So if you call us an amateur, it's not an insult.
By saying amateur and saying learning on the job is not anything that I'm particularly ashamed of. And I'm sure it's not anything that you're particularly ashamed of, because it was such a gradual process. And right now we are very much consciously incompetent. We know what we don't know. We know that we have a lot to learn. We see other people who are much better at this, and at least we can take that and learn from it. We reflect back to our early podcasting days and we cringe, but we say we're keeping it up there, because if anybody else is going to do this for any other case, you need to look at that, and you need to listen to it, and you need to listen to, don't stop at episode 5 or 6 or 7. Get through it. Get to where we start knowing, where we start being conscious of all of these things that we are not good at, and we start to fix them. It's all part of the process. So by saying amateur, at one point everybody is like an amateur filmmaker or an amateur podcaster or an amateur investigator. It's not like Tim and I are going out, unless you are, and I'm not sure, but I'm certainly not putting my name in the yellow pages for private investigation consultations. And
no, we don't have licenses for it. we can't legally do that anyway. This podcast, this project has changed our lives in so many ways. And one of the ways specifically is the truth. I now look at the truth as a tangible thing. It's like my partner here, our third partner sitting next to us.
I'm actually a little jealous that you used The truth being the third partner sitting right next to us, because I wanted that one. I wanted that one to be mine.
I see it as a tangible person. It's a character.
Yeah.
In our lives.
Right. And you know what? I'm so used to cringing from the first few episodes of the podcast that, I mean, I'm cringing thinking about the first few sentences I said in this episode. Tonight, there's always something. There's always something that you can fix, you can do better.
Right. And so I know it might be a little confusing. You've heard the word documentary. You know that there's this television show that's going to be on Oxygen that's going to air for 6 straight Saturdays starting on September 30th, 2017. But Lance and I are also going to continue and finish the documentary that we began back in 2013. So they're actually separate projects. They're both going to be available at some point. Texas Crew and Oxygen Show is going to be available this September. We don't know when ours is going to be available or where or how it's going to be available or anything like that yet. We thought that this TV show that is investigating the case with resources has a much better chance to make a difference in the case than if we pushed out our documentary.
And I remember going back and having these conversations with you about, are they on the up and up, and do we feel comfortable? Because we're not just going to hand out the contact information of the Murray family to anybody. So there was this kind of internal discussion, internal process that we had, and we made sure anytime we felt that there was something going in the wrong direction with Texas Crew, and it wasn't, we would call them. We would have, you know, they would always set our minds at ease with any the process that they had intended with this show. So we felt very comfortable. By the time we did give that contact information to them, we felt very comfortable with that connection. And as far as our documentary goes, we realized that we have enough stuff to do something really special with it. And we're going to hold on to that. And when the listeners of this show and eventually the people who watch the disappearance of Maura Murray on the Oxygen Network, and then they discover this show, when they see what we've come up with as sort of a companion piece to this whole thing, I think they're going to be really happy with the way they're consuming all of this information, as opposed to 5 or 6 years ago, the way citizen detectives and people interested in this case would have consumed this information. This is a very, we keep saying a legit investigation. We have an investigative journalist who went to UMass as part of the show, and she's awesome.
Maggie Freeling. Yeah.
And we were very happy when we were told about this investigative journalist, about Maggie being a part of the show, because it opens up that relatability.
Well, and we're not professional journalists, Lance, and we've exactly. been thrust into that role like we were talking about, but we did not go to school for journalism. We're not journalists. We're amateur journalists, essentially, is what we are.
That's exactly where I was going with that. We were so happy with the fact that they have Maggie, who is with Art, leading this investigation, backed by Texas Crew, backed by Oxygen Network, and with the footage that we have from our documentary, that companion piece part that I was talking about, you get all of the information and all of the angles without having to go through that journey that will eventually burn you out if you were to try to do this on your own 5 or 6 years ago. And I want to also add that the TV show is going to open up this case to a much, much larger audience. There's so many people out there who don't know about this case.
So this is for them, essentially.
It's for them. It's for everybody to collect their thoughts, to put everything into one basket and move forward from there.
And there's a couple of episodes that we produced back in December of 2016 called Anatomy of Missing Maura Murray. And they're episodes 34 and 35, parts 1 and 2. I recommend that you check them out if you want to know more about this podcast. So if this is the first episode that you're listening to because you just heard about this mystery, check out episodes 34 and 35. And then if you want to go back through the whole catalog, we strongly recommend that. But 34 and 35, they're kind of like best of episodes. We play a minute or two from each episode. And then if you want more information of that specific topic, go back and listen to that episode. Morimori was a 21-year-old college student who went to University of Massachusetts in Amherst, Massachusetts. On Monday, February 9th, 2004, she got into her car and she drove north to the White Mountains of New Hampshire and spun her car out on Route 112.
Now, this was a sharp, nearly 90-degree hairpin turn right on a corner that had the Westmans, the old weathered barn, and up the road, Butch Atwood's house and Bradley Hill Road.
The police report filed 6 days later will tell you that Maura hit a tree. However, we don't think that's the case. We believe she hit a snowbank. Either way, the car was not totaled. Butch Atwood, who was one of the neighbors, coincidentally, drove by in his school bus. He stopped and asked her for help, per his account. She said, "I've already called AAA." And we know that that's not true because there's no cell phone service in that spot today, let alone 2004. So Butch Atwood, again, per his account, drove down the street about a couple hundred yards, parked his bus, and he called 911 as well. It was busy. They called him back.
Well, as far as the distance is concerned from the accident site to Butch Atwood's home, it's a little debatable. We could probably say it's around 100 yards.
So two neighbors called the police. Before the police got there, Maura Murray was gone.
What we do know for the facts are at 727, Faith Westman called the police, stated that she saw the car on the side of the road, pretty much directly across the street from her home. We know for a fact that Butch Atwood went to his home, which was right across the street from Bradley Hill Road. Bradley Hill Road was also where Rick Forcier had his residence. Butch Atwood went into his house, explained to his common-law wife, Barbara, what was the scene that was happening down the street. They made an attempt to call 911. The circuits were busy. The county, Grafton County, called them back, and they gave their account at 7:43 of what was happening down the road. So when you're putting facts on this case, you really need to look at the police log. You need to look at the dispatch log, and that will at least give you a time frame. As far as where she had her accident, there's some speculation that the accident was staged. If Maura was intending to stage an accident, she could have found dozens of other places along that road, along Route 112, Kangamangas Highway, literally any road up there other than that turn to stage an accident.
That exact spot is more populated than a lot of spots that have similar dramatic turns on the road.
If she wanted to stage an accident or ditch her car, there's three or four smaller roads, some turnoffs before there that she could have taken. You said a couple of times, Butch Atwood per his account. Now, his accounts are documented in old newspaper articles where he did interviews. And we all know what eyewitness testimony is like. I didn't until we started doing this, until I was told by law enforcement how unreliable eyewitness testimony is. And he does say that he thought she was lying about calling AAA. However, you really have to take these accounts with a grain of salt, because she could have said something like, "I'm going to call AAA," or "I'm trying to call AAA," or she could have just simply held up her phone and said AAA, or some sort of indication that she was going to call AAA. And then he might have heard it as, "I'm calling AAA," or "I called AAA." So these are the things that you have to take with a grain of salt. She might not have been, quote unquote, lying to protect herself. Maybe she was. But if you're looking at this and you want to save yourself some headaches, don't take it as a blatant covering up of the truth by Maura Murray.
What I think you're getting to is the theory that Maura staged her car and ran away and is living a life somewhere else.
Oh, no. I mean, I wasn't really saying, I was saying, look at, actually, that was what I wanted to stay away from, was that you need to look at these things in small individual moments and maybe take it all with a grain of salt. Maybe Butch didn't hear it verbatim, didn't remember it verbatim.
It's important to note that there are many, many other little details about this that we're not going to talk about tonight. Please go back and listen to early episodes, watch the TV show. This is supposed to be something meant for new listeners of the case. So if you want further details on this, please go back. It's important to note that Butch Atwood has passed away. Before he passed away, he moved to Florida after this disappearance. Now, I'm not saying he's a suspect or a person of interest. I'm not saying that. I'm just giving you the facts. But he was the last person to see her alive. And if you're law enforcement and you're listening, you'd say, well, the last person to see her alive is you usually hold some answers. And you'd be correct with that. But keep in mind, he also called police. So this is a very confusing subject. If he didn't call police, it wouldn't be as confusing, probably.
When you take it at face value, if she had been found, if she had come back to her car after, you'd look at his actions and say he did exactly what human beings would do. He went to his house, he called the police. People his age tend to retire and move to Florida, and people his age with his condition tend to die. So it's also important to note that they didn't totally leave the area. So they weren't totally, him and his wife were not totally running away from that area.
That gets into these theories, right? So Maura Murray vanished. Some people think she was met with foul play. Some people think she ran away to start a new life. And some people think she committed suicide and intended to commit suicide when she left the campus of the University of Massachusetts. We cover a lot of these topics. We talk to James Renner, who has written a book about the case called True Crime Addict. We talk to Clint Harding, who is pretty convinced Maura left UMass intending to kill herself. And we've talked to John Smith, who is pretty sure Maura Murray was met with foul play up there, and he is a local to the area. So these are three of the people that we've had on the podcast who are some of the loudest voices projecting these theories out there. The views expressed by the guests on this show do not necessarily reflect our views.
We've always tried to maintain a very, very neutral view on everything.
Not always easy.
It's not easy because you do have these voices that are in your ear and they're like, well, this happened and this happened. Can't you see that this happened? How do you not see that this happened and this happened? And this is what's going to happen if people, you know, are introduced to this case right now, and you want to make these connections and you want to tell people that you're right. But you need to take a step back and you need to you can't just say because this and, you know, this happened and this happened, then this must have happened. Why can't you see that? Well, you don't have proof of that. And I want to bring up, you had brought up John Smith, and you had brought up law enforcement. And here's one good thing that comes from citizen detecting. John Smith started the change.org campaign a while ago. You know how many signatures that's gotten so far? It's gotten 11,000 signatures. Recently, the update came through, 11,000 and counting, guys. Awesome. And that is 11,000 signatures for the FBI to allocate some resources to looking into Moore's case, reopening the case if possible. It honestly, it doesn't matter. The more signatures, the better. The more attention, the better. If they can reopen the case, if they can put people on it, fantastic. That was done before a nationally televised show. It's up to 11,000 without the TV show. With the TV show, that thing's going to go through the roof. It's going to bring attention to this. Just do it. Change.org. Just do it.
The link is in the show notes. Please sign it. It's for the FBI to take over this case. 11,000 is great, but it's not everybody. Please, there is no reason not to sign this petition. And thank you so much to John and everyone else who have shared and signed this petition. It's literally heartwarming to see.
This is crowdsourcing of an investigation at its best. It doesn't happen overnight, guys. You know, when things get solved, it's usually somebody who cracks. It's usually the perpetrator who cracks, can't take it anymore. Maybe they're on their deathbed and they make a confession, or it's somebody within the organization that you know, were a part of this crime. Somebody cracks. Crowdsourcing has to be the, like you said, 11,000 is awesome, but it's not enough, but it has to be a tsunami. Like, it has to crush it. And we know that there are more people than 11,000 listening.
Well, if you want to help, that's one way that you can personally help. Listening to the show is great. Watching the television show is fantastic. Talking about it to your friends, your neighbors, your family, that's perfect. Signing the petition is helping firsthand.
Directly. You've had a direct contribution to it.
Now, let's briefly talk about some of Maura's friends and Maura's family. Let's start with her dad, Fred Murray, who has participated in the television show. And he is a guy who has never come on this podcast. So if you listen to all 55 episodes, you're not going to hear him on this podcast. You may hear some clips of him because we played some clips from other news outlets, but he's not going to come on this podcast.
I couldn't even imagine, and no one can imagine, unless it's happened directly to you, what has happened to him. And you don't know how you're going to react to a tragedy like this, a situation like this, alone. On top of the fact that now you have all of these outside influences wanting something from you, and all you want to do is find your daughter. And you have all of these outside influences seemingly wanting to move forward some sort of motivation, some sort of project, something. You would probably start to shut down a bit. You'd probably start to shut the door to a lot of these people and say, I'm focused on finding my daughter. Let them think what they want to think.
In addition to Fred Murray, Laurie Murray, Maura's mom, she passed away on Maura's birthday in 2009. She was sick, and we do get questions about her mom. How come no one ever talks about her mom? Her mom was sick at the time. She had a broken arm, I believe, at the time of Maura's disappearance. And she is now passed away. Also, the Murray family spokesperson was someone named Helena Dwyer Murray, who also recently passed away. But this is a woman who worked for 12 years, 13 years on Maura's case, and took every email that went to the family site, and she ran the family Facebook page. Maura also has some siblings, Julie Murray, went to West Point, as Maura did. Kathleen Murray is another sister of Maura. And obviously there have been many, many questions. If you look online, you'll see many questions about Kathleen. All we can tell you is that she's in the TV show.
And Julie and Kathleen, those are names that you hear about more than you hear about Maura's brother, Kurt. And Kurt is in the show as well, and it's really refreshing to see him speak. So in addition to Kurt, Maura's other brother was Fred Jr. So you have Fred Jr., you have Kurt, Julie, and Kathleen, and you have what we've come to learn and understand to be a really close-knit family, despite issues, despite things that happen to families. You have a really close-knit family. You have two brothers, two sisters to Maura. And I think what you end up finding out is that they were a very typical Irish, Northeast New England family.
Now, Maura also had friends. She had high school friends, a tight-knit group. If you've seen the Disappeared episode from a few years back, you will have seen some of her friends interviewed on that. Maura had two friends at UMass that will often come up. That's Kate and Sarah. You will hear a lot about Kate and Sarah if you read online. There is a lot of mystery surrounding these two friends.
It seems like these two friends, and we don't know. Again, you're looking at this case for the first time. You don't know what's going on. Please do not assume that people who don't speak have something to hide. We are talking about two young women who in their early 20s, in the middle of college, have this thing that's thrown on them. It's by no fault of their own. They have this thing that's thrown on them. And then people are coming out of the woodwork to ask them questions. So their lack of any communication, their desire to be left alone should be just that, a desire to be left alone.
Maura also had a boyfriend named Billy. Billy went to West Point and met Maura there. Billy was in the Army and stationed in Oklahoma at the time Maura went missing. He's on the Disappeared episode, if you've seen that, and you can check this one out on YouTube. Obviously, when foul play happens or when someone goes missing, law enforcement will look at the people closest to the person who went missing or the victim. A lot of times people will automatically suspect Billy of some wrongdoing, but the fact is he was in Oklahoma at the time. Some things you will find about him, if you look into it, might be head-scratching to you. Don't let his silence convince you that he is guilty of anything.
Yeah, come back to the fact that think about what you were doing when you were, and I know he was military trained, but come back to what were you doing and where was your head at when you were between the age of 18 and 24 years old, and then have this put on you, and then later on be questioned about certain things that you said and did as if there was some sort of suspicion or some you had some guilt associated. When you look into it, you have to take that into consideration. These people who are involved in this case back in 2004 had no idea what their life was going to be. They were trying to figure things out. And then you have this put on them. Any action after that, any action within the first year of that, if it's been cleared by, if they weren't arrested, they probably didn't have anything to do with it. And all of these suspicious actions are only people who are established in their lives and looking back on it now in as the Monday morning quarterback and saying, why is that strange? That, why would they do that? And you look at Sarah and Kate and Billy. And if you were back there, you'd probably do something equally as suspicious looking or irresponsible
or puzzling 13 years later.
Exactly. Someone puts a microphone in your face or you're on, you know, when you're on the ground looking for your girlfriend at the time who hasn't been heard from in 3 days and reporters ask you questions. No one that age, I don't care if you went to military school. No one's been trained for that. No one's told. No one knows how to properly answer those questions. You're going to misspeak.
Now, none of this is us saying Billy is innocent. Billy is guilty. Kate knows something. We're not saying anything either way. We're just introducing you to these people. Listen to the podcast. Watch the TV show. Make up your mind yourself.
Don't jump to conclusions. Open all the doors, as one of our guests said, that I loved. And look at all the contents behind those doors. Put yourself in that situation. Understand that life is not always a conspiracy.
There are so many additional details and there are so many additional characters that we just can't get into in this episode right now. Again, we invite you to watch the new TV show. We invite you to listen to the catalog of podcasts that we have. We don't have the time tonight to talk about Witness A.
To talk about the UMass cabin.
Or the potential of a serial killer and the connection with Brianna Maitland.
Or the rag in the tailpipe.
Or the threatening emails we got in episode 16.
Or when Maura had to be guided back from her job by her boss the night that she received a phone call and was crying and broke down and said, my sister.
Or the rusty knife, red truck, and A-frame house. These are things we're not going to talk about right now, but they are in the catalog of episodes and they will be talked about on the TV show. And the goal of the TV show is to put a lot of these questions to bed.
And isn't that the very definition of the amateur detective, of the citizen detective, of the thing that we have stumbled into, have gradually become, is that we were a conduit for these questions. And we filtered them out, we addressed them, we discussed them, and the show approached us, the production company approached us, and they were able to dismiss or qualify these issues. That came up from the crowdsourced information. So this whole thing is really a statement about when a case is ready to go cold 13 years later, ready to go cold big time permanently, it's gotten new life. So all of that journey, all of those questions, everything that we talked about is ready to either be put to bed or put into a file that is classified as important and needs to be looked at. We don't always see the forest through the trees, right? So we might miss something. We might see something that shouldn't, that we focus on that we shouldn't focus on. And people from the peripheral might look at that and say, not that, maybe this. It's happened. You know, we've seen that happen. If you're passionate about it, be passionate about it and be responsible about it. That's something that we've always said, to the point of like, I'm annoyingly preachy about it, is if you're passionate, take that passion and arm that with responsibility. And thank you for listening, and thank you for being passionate, and thank you for being responsible. And you see the difference that it makes. You literally will watch the difference that it makes. It's crazy.
You said sometimes we can't see the forest through the trees. And if you just picked a random episode and started listening to it, you'd feel that way. You'd be dropped in the middle of a forest without any context. So that's why this episode is important, because there are so many new people who are going to be hearing about this mystery because of this television show. If you want to get involved physically, there's someone named Nancy who is organizing a boots on the ground search for May of 2018. Connect with her on Facebook.
And even if that boots on the ground search, I know people are listening to and they're like, oh, 2018? Like, what are we possibly going to find in 2018? I'll tell you what you'll find. You'll find out. If you don't find any evidence, you'll find out what it's like to be in the woods up there. And that's really important to know.
And that's one of the reasons I mentioned it, is because we'll get emails because of this episode saying how well were the woods searched? And we weren't there back in 2004. We can't speak to it personally. But what we can do is direct you to episode 29 and a man named Rick Graves, who searched with Fred Murray for years in those woods.
Not only searched with Fred Murray, he searched with Fred Murray with law enforcement at Connection. Those woods were hit hard, as he says.
And as the very successful criminologist from the UK, David Wilson, said in episode 28, we are a very small piece of humanity in a very large world. So there is absolutely a chance that people have overlooked things, people have stepped over things that could lead to answers.
Before we wrap up here, and I know a lot of it is a bit redundant for the people who have been following us for so long, and that's cool, awesome. Can't possibly express any more gratitude for the people who have been following us this long, because you're the reason why we're here, and you're the reason why it's going to, you know, we're finally going to be on the summit and see what potential this case can, the investigation for this case can have. But other than the TV show, I wanted to ask you, Tim, what is a moment that will always be in your head over the past 2 years in reference to this case and this investigation?
This is one of the most meaningful things I've ever done. I've worked in the entertainment industry. I've worked on film projects. Nothing has even come close to how meaningful this has been in my life. And meeting these people like John Smith, like James, like Nancy, like people who care, who wear their hearts on their sleeves. It's a life-changing experience. How about you?
If I were to think of one, now that was a question that I had, it's probably a little unfair that I'm answering this because that was a question that I told you at the beginning of the episode that I wasn't going to tell you what the question was so that I could get a genuine answer. So my answer, if I had to, outside of the TV show stuff, think of a moment that is sort of ingrained in my head right now. And it, I guess it does speak to the character of the people that we've met. The moment that really, I don't know why I keep going back to, but it's with John Smith in the parking lot of the motel when we saw the bear. And this is a true story. I don't know if we've ever said this on the show. We were up there shooting video, shooting for the documentary, and we met up with John Smith, and I was talking to our camera guy, Josh, outside, and turn around, and there's a brown bear in the parking lot of a motel in between a couple of cars. And you know, I've never been that close to a bear, 12, 15 feet away. And I remember we were both knocking on the door, and we were like, holy shit, it's a bear, it's a bear. And we went inside, and I think you were trying to get a camera to shoot it.
Yeah, you were knocking so fast that we thought you were joking.
Right.
We're like, oh, they're just being weirdos outside. And we didn't open the door very quickly.
Right. And in the meantime, this bear's lumbering. I'm not kidding. This bear was lumbering like doo-doo-doo, like towards us. And I just remember this moment with John after we got inside. He was like, I want to see it. And we go outside and just having John in front of me and walking around, and we saw where the bear was down this hall of the motel. It was like the outdoor hall, and the bear is tearing apart the trash can, and John's just looking at it like it's this, like it's the most beautiful thing he's ever seen. Like he was just amazed by this thing, and he had no problem looking at it and talking about it. And most people would, I don't know, most people would have just gone inside and peeked through the window, but he wanted to get close to this bear. He was looking at it, and he just thought it was, I remember him talking about it and saying, oh, he's trying to find something to eat. Like, he was, like, there. And the bear was there. And I felt like nothing. I remember making a comment like, what would you do if it, like, charged at you? And he was like, well, buddy, I'd turn around and run as fast as shit back to the room. But I felt like that just wasn't going to happen with him there. And that's like the one moment that I remember so vividly, and it's got nothing to do with the case, but it has everything to do with the type of people that are part of this.
We can't possibly mention all the people who have helped and who have moved us along the way, but shout out to Alex, Chloe, Marley, KF, Clint, Rick Graves, Aurelia, John's Truth Seekers group.
And let's not forget Aaron Larkin, who now not only has provided an amazing amount of detail and information and insight to the police logs and the general going-ons of that area. She also contributes to the whole citizen detective world with her new podcast as well, which is 107 Degrees. So give that a listen.
And the list goes on and on, quite frankly. The people on Reddit.
Even the people who didn't want to, you know, they wanted to contribute, but they didn't want to come on directly to the show. The people who listened, that we know listened, and just liked listening, and they liked the experience, like John Ronson, like the owners of the A-Frame House at the time when we went to the 12-year anniversary. They had serious information that they, important information, and they, but, you know, they understood that this wasn't something that was like, let's do it to get our name out there.
It's been a wild ride, Lance, and it's been an emotional roller coaster, quite frankly. And I have no doubt that the television show is also going to be an emotional roller coaster. So please buckle up, watch all 6 episodes, and try to hold back your opinion until after you finish watching the entire series. Also, we've been getting some questions from people from other countries. How can I watch this television show? And we have told you we're going to try to have an answer for you. I do know that Voodoo is streaming it, I think, for a price. But there may be an additional answer coming soon. So we'll have an update for you there.
We started off with a bad metaphor about climbing a mountain that, you know, I just kind of started saying off the cuff. But, you know, it is exhausting and it is emotional. And it is whether it's the mountain metaphor or it's a boxing metaphor. You know, once you reach a certain round, once you reach a certain mile marker, if you're running a marathon, once you reach something and you see some sort of fruit of your labor, you do get emotional. You do start reflecting back at the journey. And people need to know that the journey is as important as the actual conclusion and any resolution that can happen.